Imagine looking your new husband dead in the eye, surrounded by the just freezing, unforgiving wilderness of 1670s Quebec, and daring him to try and steal your children's
Oh, yeah,
inheritance.
just daring him to test
But
me.
right, and winning, because that is exactly what your ancestor Suzanne did. So welcome to our deep dive.
Yeah, we're so glad you're here with us.
Today we are opening up an incredibly rare, monumental text, the 1987 centennial book called Onward to the Unknown.
And this deep dive is custom tailored entirely for you because we are tracing the grand sweeping epic of your own family's history.
To the Layer family.
Yeah, it's a narrative that fundamentally redefines how we look at survival. I mean, we are following a single bloodline as it progresses from 17th century France across the Atlantic.
Right into the absolute harshest pioneer days of the Canadian West.
Exactly, and straight through the whiplash of 20th century technological and social shifts.
We're talking about the overarching epic timeline today. I do want to note for you listening that in future deep dives, we are going to zoom in on the incredibly rich, specific stories of individual branches of your family.
Oh, absolutely. There's so much there.
But our mission today is the grand scope, the sweeping arc of it all. Okay, let's unpack this because to fully grasp this material, we have to strip away the sepia-toned flat history book filter.
Yeah, you have to, because you are not just listening to a sequence of dates or like an academic catalog of events. You are listening to the precise, unbroken recipe of resilience and stubbornness and humor that culminated in your own existence.
It's literally the grit that made you.
Right? Every impossible winter they survived, every desperate gamble they took, every quiet moment of frontier ingenuity, it all li literally built the foundation for you to be sitting here listening to this right now.
Wow.
I mean, if one of these ancestors makes a different choice on a Tuesday in 1885, you simply do not exist.
That is a staggering thought to hold on to as we go back to the very beginning. So we're starting in the 1600s with the first Canadian ancestors in your family, Simon and his wife, Suzanne.
All right, Simon comes over from France around 1652.
Yeah. He's recruited to colonize. He marries Suzanne in 1655. They acquire land and they have seven children, five girls and two boys.
And Simon is a prominent guy.
He really is. He's actively involved in the Sovereign Council of Quebec, which was essentially the governing body of the colony at the time. They are building a life. But then the anchor drops.
Yeah, things change fast.
In 1670, Simon passes away. Suzanne is suddenly a widow on the absolute edge of the known world with seven children and a working farm.
And the vulnerability of her position cannot be overstated here. In the 1670s, the socio-legal structure of New France did not offer safety nets for unprotected women.
Let alone a woman trying to manage a farm and a large brood of children through Canadian winters.
Exactly. Remarriage was rarely a purely romantic endeavor, right? It was an urgent socioeconomic necessity. It was a merger for survival.
So Suzanne does what she has to do. She prepares to draw up a marriage contract with a man named Robert Coutard.
But before she actually marries him, though, Suzanne initiates a process that fundamentally changes the trajectory of your family line. She takes an inventory.
Right, but I want to be clear about what an inventory meant for Suzanne. She didn't just walk around the house jotting down a few notes.
Oh, no. She spent an entire month executing a microscopic, agonizingly detailed audit of her entire existence.
A whole month.
Yeah, she documented the 58 acres of land, the cultivated fields, the prairie grass, the house, the barn, the outdoor oven.
Every single animal on the property.
Every kitchen utensil. Down to a single specific item, which was a small family mirror.
A small family mirror. Let's examine the mechanics of what she is doing here, because it is just legal brilliance.
It really is. Under the customary laws of the time when a widow remarried, the new husband typically absorbed the management and often the ownership of the existing estate.
Wow. So if Suzanne walks into that marriage blindly, Simon's hard-won assets become Robert's assets.
Exactly. Her seven children could be left with nothing.
So by spending a month cataloging every spoon, every acre, and that small mirror before the wedding vows are exchanged, she is constructing an indisputable legal fortress. She is establishing a baseline.
It's essentially a 17th century ironclad prenuptial agreement.
But instead of a team of corporate lawyers, it's one widow with a quill pen on the frontier.
Right. And the inclusion of that small family mirror tells us so much. I mean, a mirror in 1670s Quebec wasn't just a piece of glass you bought at a convenience store.
It was a massive luxury. It was fragile. It had to be shipped across the Atlantic, and it represented a connection to civilization.
It was a piece of their identity. She made sure the legal authorities knew that mirror belonged to her first children.
And her strategic foresight was tested almost immediately. because in 1672, Suzanne and her new husband, Robert, have their first child together.
And the ink is barely dry on their lives when Robert makes his move. He formally contests the inheritance.
Of course he does.
He attempts to maneuver his new child into the original property division, essentially trying to cannibalize the assets that rightfully belong to Simon's seven children.
He tries to dilute the estate. And Suzanne's response is legendary. The historical record shows she let him know in no uncertain terms that if he were to ask for too much, he could land up with very little.
She called his bluff.
She dared him to challenge the legal fortress she built during that month-long inventory.
And it worked. He backed down, accepted a minor portion of the land, and the inheritance of Simon's children was preserved.
We really need to follow the causality of that standoff, because if Robert successfully absorbs that estate, Simon's sons, including your direct ancestor, Sixtay, who was merely a toddler during this legal battle, are likely displaced.
Yeah, without land or resources, their prospects of marrying, acquiring their own farms, and continuing the family line diminished drastically.
So Suzanne's inventory wasn't just administrative housekeeping. It was the physical anchor that prevented your family from being washed away into historical obscurity.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
And when you read through the family archives, you start to notice this recurring DNA, this calculated fierce drive for survival.
This instinct to secure better pastures for the family against overwhelming odds, it skips across the generations.
We are going to jump forward roughly 200 years from the 1670s to the late 1800s.
The landscape of North America has transformed, but the harsh economic reality hasn't. And the exact same matriarchal instinct we saw in Suzanne lands squarely on the shoulders of a young man named Moise.
Moise is born in 1858 in Quebec. By 1877, he is 19 years old, and Quebec is suffocating under severe economic depression.
Arable land is scarce, families are massive, and opportunities are non-existent. Moise looks at his environment and makes a cold, hard calculation. He has to go west.
He tells his girlfriend, Sophie, that he is leaving to find land and make something of himself. But he promises he will return to marry her.
He takes a boat, then a train as far as Winnipeg, and in 1877, Winnipeg was the literal end of the line.
The railroad tracks just stopped in the mud.
Literally in the mud. From Winnipeg, Moise walks. He walks along the invisible survey lines in the vast prairie with barely any provisions.
He finds work at sawmills, and eventually he finds himself doing the most brutal labor available, which is building the railroad through the Rocky Mountains.
The Crow's Nest Pass in the late 1800s was a meat grinder. Building a railway through that terrain before modern machinery meant manual labor in its purest, most punishing form.
We are talking about men swinging pickaxes into solid granite, hauling ties up sheer inclines.
Dealing with sudden avalanches, sub-zero temperatures, and rampant disease in the camps.
Moise didn't just survive this environment, he thrived in it. He hoarded his wages, enduring the physical toll solely to fund the promise he made back in Quebec.
True to his word, 4 years later, in 1881, he takes those wages, travels all the way back across the country to Quebec, marries Sophie, and brings her west.
But the west they return to is a powder keg.
It really is. They arrive in Winnipeg, start their family, and Moise sets his sights on the Battleford area in Saskatchewan. In 1885, they load up their wagons and head out, and they walk blindly into the Northwest Rebellion.
The 1885 Rebellion was a watershed moment of violent upheaval. Métis and First Nations peoples facing starvation and broken treaties from the Canadian government rose up.
The frontier was in absolute chaos. Moise, driving a wagon with Sophie and their young children, attempts to seek refuge inside Fort Battleford.
But the fort is completely overwhelmed with terrified settlers. The authorities look at Moise, see his family, and refuse them entry.
They tell him to detour all the way to Moose Jaw,
which is hundreds of miles away in the opposite direction.
Moise ignores them. He turns his wagon away from the fort and heads straight for the Rocky Mountains to hide.
Sophie actually gives birth to a baby Leonidas while they're hiding out in the mountains.
Which is just incredible. Once the violence of the rebellion subsides, they decide to try for Battleford again. And this is where we encounter a moment that I find incredibly haunting.
Yeah, this part is tough.
Yeah. They camp for the night on the trail. They wake up in the morning and their draft horses are gone, stolen, in the middle of the empty frontier.
We really have to understand the gravity of that moment. A pioneer family stranded on the trail without draft animals is not facing a mere inconvenience. They are facing an existential threat.
A wagon cannot be moved by human strength alone.
Right. Without horses, they cannot hunt efficiently, they cannot transport water, they cannot outrun weather. They are marooned.
Moise tracks the area and encounters some freighters who deliver the grim reality. Horse thieves from across the U.S. border likely took them. The horses are gone forever.
So Moise has to figure out a way to procure an animal out of thin air. He has one item of significant value on him, a gold watch.
He finds someone with an Indian pony and he barters that gold watch for the pony just to keep his family moving.
I really want to pause on that gold watch. In 1885, for a working-class pioneer who'd just spent years breaking rocks in the Crow's Nest Pass, a gold watch is not merely a device to tell time.
It is a profound status symbol.
It might have been a family heirloom from Quebec, or perhaps the single luxury he purchased to prove to himself that his brutal labor meant something.
It represented his identity as a civilized man, his connection to the modern world.
And in the dust of the prairie, he has to unclip it, hand it over to a stranger, and trade his past purely to buy his family a future. It is the ultimate psychological sacrifice.
So what does this all mean? Well, while Moise is making these heavy, defining trades, think about Sophie's reality. She is thousands of miles away from the convents of Quebec where she was educated.
She is raising toddlers in the back of a wooden wagon.
To cross the North Saskatchewan River, they couldn't just use a bridge. They had to physically swim their cattle across the churning water.
Sophie had to help take the wheels off the buggy, place the carriage on makeshift log rafts, and float it across, all while tending to a newborn baby.
And battling thick, blinding swarms of black flies. The physical endurance required from her is staggering.
But their endurance pays off. In 1887, having survived the rebellion, the horse thieves, the river crossings, and the elements, Moise successfully obtains a homestead in the Jackfish Lake area.
And this marks a massive transition in your family's narrative. The urgent scrambling era of mere survival begins to close.
Right. The question is, no longer will we live to see tomorrow. The new question is, how do we build an empire out of dirt?
We transition from surviving to thriving, and they don't do it quietly. Moise and Sophie settle on a side hill on the north side of Jackfish Creek, and they proceed to raise 15 children on this homestead.
15. The scale of what they had to build just to sustain that many human lives is mind-bending.
The expansion of their operation was relentless. Moise initially relies on slow, plodding oxen to break the sod and haul hay. Oxen are incredibly strong, but agonizingly slow.
As soon as the homestead begins generating capital, Moise upgrades. He doesn't just buy regular horses, he invests in purebred Percherons.
These are massive, muscular, elite draft horses. They were the tractors of their day, and Moise was fiercely proud of them.
Which leads to my absolute favorite dynamic in the entire source material.
Oh, me too. You have Moise, the proud, tough pioneer, admiring his massive Percherons. And then you have Sophie.
Her granddaughter, Claire, vividly remembers Sophie rolling her eyes, looking out the window and teasing him.
She would say, "Look at the old thing, spending money on horses."
It is such a brilliantly normal, universal marriage dynamic playing out in the 1890s. While they are carving a life out of the wilderness.
It grounds them. It reminds us that they weren't stoic statues. They were a husband and wife playfully bickering over the household budget.
And speaking of the household budget, while Moise is out expanding the herds, eventually running up to 400 sheep, Sophie is architecting a domestic infrastructure that rivals a modern factory.
To call her a homemaker is wildly insufficient. She was the CEO of a complex manufacturing plant.
Let's break down the mechanics of Sophie's manufacturing plant. They weren't going to a general store to buy clothes.
Sophie washed raw, grease-laden sheep's wool by hand. She carded it, which means using wire-tooth brushes to painfully detangle and align the fibers.
She spun that wool on a spinning wheel and then knitted thick woolen socks, sweaters, and mittens for 15 growing children.
She managed the poultry. When chicks were born in the freezing spring, she would literally bring them into the kitchen, wrap them up, and keep them warm inside the compartments of the wood-burning cookstove so they wouldn't freeze to death.
And her engineering of food preservation is particularly impressive. Without electricity or ice boxes, keeping dairy from spoiling in the summer heat was a critical problem.
Sophie manufactured her own butter using wooden molds. To keep it cold, she designed a refrigeration system using the ambient ground temperature of their drinking well.
She built a custom cupboard, attached it to a rope and pulley system, and would physically lower the heavy cupboard deep down the well shaft, hovering just above the waterline.
Pulling it up every time they needed fresh butter, the physical labor of hauling a wooden cupboard full of dairy up a well multiple times a day is a workout we can't even fathom.
But what strikes me is the sheer intellectual horsepower required to run this operation. Moise and Sophie were brilliant in entirely different ways.
Sophie had formal education from a convent in Quebec. Moise had zero formal schooling, When they first married, he couldn't even write his own name.
Sophie had to sit down and teach him how to sign legal documents.
And yet, Moyse possessed an extraordinary spatial and mathematical intelligence.
The sources note that he could stand in a field, look at a massive, irregularly shaped haystack, and calculate its exact total cubic feet entirely in his head.
He was doing complex geometric volume equations mentally while managing massive herds of livestock and directing the agricultural expansion of the ranch.
The synthesis of Sophie's organizational and structural education with Moyse's raw spatial intellect made them an unstoppable team.
Unstoppable and highly entrepreneurial. Which brings me to the legendary 10-gallon home-brewed beer recipe.
Oh, yes.
Sophie wasn't just knitting socks and churning butter. She was running a covert frontier tavern out of her kitchen.
The sheer chemistry and precision of her brewing process is fascinating.
Exactly. I want to walk you through exactly what your ancestor was doing. She would take 10 pounds of raw barley and spread it out in her wood stove oven, roasting it until it hit the perfect shade of brown.
Meanwhile, she's boiling a pound of hops on the stove for 2 solid hours.
She prepares a yeast cake, activating it with a precise mixture of flour and water, waiting until the ambient temperature of the kitchen hits exactly 65 degrees.
But her secret weapon, the color and the flavor.
She would take brown sugar, melt it in a heavy pan until it caramelized into a thick, dark syrup, and pour that boiling sugar into a massive 45-gallon wooden barrel to give the beer its rich amber color and distinct taste.
This wasn't just a hobby for family gatherings. Sophie was a shrewd businesswoman.
She situated this enormous 45-gallon barrel behind a large cupboard in the kitchen to keep it hidden.
The Jackfish Lake area was a thoroughfare for travelers, freighters, and government men.
When they passed through, Sophie would secretly sell glasses of her homebrew. She was generating independent, untracked revenue for the homestead right under the noses of the authorities.
Imagine your grandparents or great-grandparents operating this bustling micro-economy where every single item you wore, ate, or drank was made by hand.
So you have a massive ranch, hundreds of sheep, purebred horses, a well-pulley refrigerator, a secret brewery, and 15 children running around this booming property.
This naturally leads us to wonder, what was life actually like for the kids growing up in the middle of this bustling microeconomy?
What was the childhood experience for the next generation of the family?
We don't have to guess because we have the incredible vivid memoirs of Roland Moyse and Sophie's grandsons.
His writings pulled the curtain back on the 1910s and 1920s, giving us a front row seat to how the frontier shaped the minds of children.
Roland's stories are a wild mix of survival training and pure, unadulterated mischief.
Before they had access to manufactured toys, Roland and his friends would go out to the ravines and play a game they just called Ranch.
They would spend hours gathering hundreds of specific stones. Big blue stones represented the bulls. Smaller brown stones were the cows.
Tiny white pebbles were the calves. They built intricate corrals out of sticks and string, and they would spend the entire day trading, selling, and managing these stone herds, mimicking exactly what Moyse was doing out in the real pastures.
It's a perfect sociological example of children socializing themselves into the survival mechanics of their environment.
Mm-hmm.
They're mapping the adult economy onto their play.
But of course, they were still kids, and they required discipline. The frontier didn't have timeouts.
To keep them in line, the parents utilized a very specific, terrifying psychological tool, which was the threat of the croque-mitaine.
The French-Canadian boogeyman.
Precisely. The croque-mitaine was the monster waiting in the dark for disobedient children. Roland's memoir details how effective this was.
As soon as the sun went down over the prairie, the psychological terror of the croque-mitaine would set in.
The kids would be so terrified of the dark that they would all sprint into the bedroom and cram together into one single bed, practically suffocating each other.
Jumping at every single creak of the floorboards or howl of the wind.
They were scared of the dark. But in the daylight, they were little hustlers.
Oh, absolutely. The local municipality and the government recognized that gophers were destroying the crops, so they offered a bounty. Two or three cents for every gopher tail.
That was real money for a kid in the 1910s. Now, most kids would carry heavy buckets of cold water out to the fields, pouring bucket after bucket down a hole, hoping to drown the gopher out.
It was exhausting. Moyse watches this and decides to intervene with an absolute life hack.
Moyse's solution is a masterclass in efficiency. He takes a half barrel, fills it with water, and heats it over a fire until it is boiling hot.
He places the boiling barrel on a stone boat, a flat wooden sled used for hauling rocks, and hitches it to a team of horses.
He drives the kids and the boiling water out to the gopher fields. Instead of hauling endless buckets, Moyes takes just one single cup of that scalding hot water and pours it down a hole.
The sheer heat and steam caused the gopher to launch out of the hole instantly. The kids made an absolute killing on bounties that day.
But the ingenuity wasn't always directed at chores. Let's talk about the sled dogs.
Oh, yes. Roland and his buddy Gene decide they want to run a dog team. They don't have trained huskies, so they just start catching every stray dog wandering around the town.
They assemble a chaotic pack of 9 dogs. They've got 2 huskies, 2 German shepherds, and a whole bunch of mutts that Roland hilariously describes as looking like a cross between a collie and a barbed wire fence.
The logistics of hiding 9 stolen dogs from your parents on a farm is quite a feat.
They tunneled under a massive straw stack and kept the dogs tied up in the dark so the thick straw would muffle their barking.
And their training methods were questionable. They designated a lead dog, but the dog couldn't understand the standard mushing commands, G and haw, for left and right.
So to steer the sled, Roland and Gene had to physically reach forward, grab the dog by his harness, and yank him in the direction they wanted to go.
Because of this maneuver, they named the lead dog Suitcase. You just grab him by the handle and turn him.
What's fascinating here is the sled dog story, while humorous captures a society rapidly straddling 2 eras.
Roland and his peers are utilizing indigenous travel methods, dog sleds, while simultaneously witnessing the relentless encroachment of modernity.
The bridge between the pioneer era and the industrial age is happening literally in their backyard.
It really is. The railroad ran right through their town of Delmas. Roland writes about the absolute magic of the circus train.
When the massive locomotive had to stop in Delmas to take on water, the teachers would actually let all the kids out of the schoolhouse.
They would sprint down to the tracks and stand mere feet away from brightly colored boxcars, listening to the muffled roars of lions and tigers echoing out over the Saskatchewan prairie.
It must have felt like aliens landing.
He also documents the construction of the very first highway passing near their property. Roland and his friends walk down to the construction camp, and they are mesmerized by the sheer scale of the operation.
It's a world opening up. They see a black camp cook for the very first time in their lives, who kindly gives them raisin cookies.
They see a Shetland pony. They are standing on the fault line of history, watching the isolation of the frontier evaporate.
But, you know, I do want to push back a bit on the romanticization of this childhood, though.
Right, because reading about circus trains and dog sleds named Suitcase, it sounds like an idyllic, fun Tom Sawyer adventure.
But the reality is that these kids were subjected to brutal, grueling labor. They weren't just playing. They were essential farmhands.
Roland describes the daily reality of hauling heavy, sloshing barrels of water for miles just to supply the house.
Before they even walked to school, they were in the massive barns, shoveling out mountains of manure by hand.
They stood on the roofs of their houses watching neighbors battle catastrophic forest fires. The threat of ruin was always there.
That is a crucial corrective. The playfulness was a coping mechanism layered over a harsh economic reality.
Yeah.
And even their pranks had a sharp, dangerous edge to them, born of a rough environment.
Dangerous is an understatement. Look at the staple incident.
Roland and his sister Yvonne decided it would be a fun prank to take a sharp metal fencing staple and carefully place it inside the nostril of an old, exhausted farmhand who was sleeping in the bunk shack.
The man wakes up in agony, realizes what happened, and violently kicks Yvonne in the rear. Roland is so terrified, he dives under a table, genuinely fearing for his life.
Or the incident with Sophie's hidden liquor. Rosianna Wilfred and Antoine are poking around the root cellar, looking into the dark dirt holes, and they discover Sophie's secret stash of booze.
Being curious kids, they drink it. But then the panic sets in. They realize that if Moyes finds empty liquor bottles, the punishment will be severe.
So they scramble and refill the empty bottles with cold tea.
And it backfires spectacularly. Moyes brings home a visiting government official, wants to show off his hospitality, and pours the man a stiff glass of his premium liquor.
The official takes a massive gulp and gets a mouthful of cold, bitter tea.
Moyes starts screaming curses, tearing the house apart, and the kids are just hiding in absolute terror. It's hilarious now, but in the moment, the stakes of their mischief were incredibly high.
The resilience of youth is adaptable, but that playful ingenuity of the 1920s was about to hit a brick wall. A global devastating brick wall.
As we move forward in the timeline, the family marches straight out of the relative boom of the pioneer days and directly into the crushing, suffocating hardships of the 1930s.
The Great Depression.
The
Dirty 30s. This is the era where the primal survival instincts we saw in Suzanne in the 1600s and Moyes in the 1880s have to instantly reactivate in the modern generation.
Farming, which had been the engine of their wealth, completely collapses. Drought destroys the crops. Dust storms bury the fences.
So the family has to pivot aggressively just to keep calories in their bodies.
The 1930s on the Canadian prairie required a feral level of economic creativity. The sources detail how traditional agriculture failed, forcing the family into entirely different industries overnight. Let's look at Joe LaRue.
Joe looks at the dead fields and turns to the water. He starts commercial ice fishing on Jackfish Lake in the absolute dead of winter.
To avoid freezing to death on the open ice, he builds cabooses, these small insulated wooden shacks mounted on sled runners with tiny wood stoves inside.
He hauls them out onto the frozen lake, but catching the fish is only half the battle. The economics of the 1930s fish market were completely unhinged.
The volatility of commodities during the Depression was extreme. It was a buyer's market entirely devoid of regulation.
It was like high-frequency day trading, but with frozen fish. Joe would pull his nets in the morning, and the going rate from the local buyer was 10 cents a pound.
But Joe would hear a rumor that a rival buyer from a different territory was arriving on the evening train. Suddenly, a bidding war erupts, and by nightfall, the price shoots up to 36 cents a pound.
Joe is aggressively hustling to maximize his margins. He figures out that unfrozen fresh fish fetches a premium price.
So he loads his sleighs with massive 45-gallon drums, fills them with lake water, drops the live fish in, and drives his sleighs through the freezing night to the train station just to protect his product from freezing solid.
He's running a frantic logistical empire in sub-zero temperatures.
Meanwhile, Pierre faces a different kind of economic nightmare. Pierre managed to scrape together enough capital to open a general store and run the local post office.
On paper, being a merchant during a depression seems safer than farming. But Pierre's store is in a community where he is blood-related to nearly 75% of the population.
The emotional toll on Pierre must have been suffocating. People are starving. The crops are dead. His uncles, his cousins, his childhood neighbors are walking into his store with hollow eyes asking for flour and sugar on credit.
Pierre physically cannot say no. He cannot watch his blood starve. So their charge accounts balloon and they can't pay.
To keep the store from going bankrupt, Pierre abandons currency entirely and reverts to a pure barter economy.
He transforms his store into a clearinghouse for raw goods. People bring him whatever they can scrape together, like a few eggs, a pound of butter, cords of chopped wood, trapped furs.
Pierre notes in the records that the indigenous populations from the nearby reserves became his most reliable economic partners. They would trade wild meat and fish for supplies, and Pierre emphasized their absolute honesty in settling debts when the colonial economy completely abandoned them.
But the stress breaks Pierre. He and his wife Annie are drowning in their own massive doctor bills. To save his family, Pierre has to make a sacrifice that echoes Moyes trading his gold watch.
Pierre owns a prized, perfectly matched team of black draft horses. These animals weighed 1,800 pounds each. They were the pride of his life.
But his kids need mastoid ear operations to prevent deafness or worse. Pierre swallows his pride, sells his beloved black horses for cash, and pays the surgeon.
The sheer emotional violence of the 1930s spared no one.
And the physical violence of the era was just as relentless. Medical care was scarce, primitive, and often too far away to matter.
Arthur is running a blacksmith shop to generate extra cash hammering red-hot metal. A shard of steel violently chips off the anvil and flies directly into his eye.
Because it was his only good eye to begin with, the injury is a catastrophic, life-altering event. The eye cannot be saved, and it has to be surgically removed. He has to learn to navigate the world and his work half-blind.
The tragedies compound. Think about Emily. She marries a young, hard-working farmhand named Patrick. It's Christmas time, 1922. The official depression hasn't hit yet, but the rural poverty is already suffocating.
Emily is pregnant with their first baby. Patrick goes out to work in the freezing Saskatchewan winter. He catches a chill because he simply does not own warm enough long underwear.
A chill turns into pneumonia. Over a horrific four-day period over Christmas, Emily watches her young husband drown in his own lung fluid and die.
She is left a widow pregnant, relying on a meager $7 government relief check just to buy enough sugar and flour to survive.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The visual manifestations of this profound poverty were stark. Perhaps nothing symbolizes the technological regression of the family during the 1930s better than the invention of the Bennett buggy.
Wait, I have to explain the Bennett buggy because it is the most bizarre apocalyptic visual imaginable.
Arthur owned a car, a motorized vehicle, but nobody had cash to buy gasoline. Gas was a luxury.
So Arthur takes his car, a symbol of 20th century progress, and he rips the heavy internal combustion engine completely out of the front chaffee to lighten the load.
He attaches wooden wagon shafts to the front bumper, and he hitches his horses to the car. You have the team of horses pulling an empty automobile across the prairie.
They named them Bennett Buggies as a massive insult to the Canadian Prime Minister R.B. Bennett, whom they blamed for the crisis. It's taking a time machine backward.
But if we want to truly understand the psychological weight of the era, the most emotionally resonant account comes from Matilda.
Yeah, the archives provide a devastating minute-by-minute documentation of her last day on the farm in June of 1944.
Matilda and her husband, Bert, fought the dirt for 25 years. A quarter of a century of their blood and sweat poured into their farm, and they finally hit the wall.
The economics break them. They are forced to surrender. They have to sell every single thing they own at a public auction and move to British Columbia.
On the morning of the auction, strangers are arriving to pick over their lives. Matilda is standing in her kitchen baking dream bars in the old wood stove to take on the train ride.
She looks down at the cast iron oven door, and she is suddenly violently ambushed by a memory of their struggle.
The memory she recalls is a microscopic vignette of the razor's edge of survival. She is transported back to a freezing morning years prior.
A sow had given birth, but the temperature plummeted and the newborn piglets were turning blue, completely stiff. Her husband Bert assumed they were dead and threw the tiny bodies onto the manure pile.
But as he walked away, one of the frozen blue legs twitched.
Matilda instantly kicks into gear. She runs out, gathers up the freezing piglets, brings them into the kitchen, opens that exact oven door, and lays their stiff, freezing little bodies directly on the warm iron to thaw them out.
And they survive. The runt of the litter who had suffered a broken hip becomes an indoor pet named Teddy.
Teddy would literally follow Matilda's daughter on her walk to school, his little hooves clicking on the kitchen linoleum. It's a beautiful memory of preservation.
But then her mind shifts to the darker days. She remembers the family dog.
This memory underscores the lethal nature of a working farm. Her son Fred had found an old unwashed syrup pail out in the field.
Not knowing its history, he used it to mix a batch of warm milk for a stubborn calf. The calf refused to drink and knocked the pail over.
The family dog, eager for a treat, ran over and lapped up the spilled milk from the dirt.
But that syrup pail hadn't just held syrup. It had been previously used to mix deadly arsenic gopher poison, the residual poison mixed with the milk.
The boys realize what's happening as the dog starts convulsing. They desperately try to save him.
They pry the dog's mouth open, forcing mustard and milk down its throat, trying to induce vomiting. They try running the dog around the yard to keep its heart beating.
But the poison is too fast. The dog goes stiff and dies right there in the dirt. Matilda is reliving this intense trauma, and she walks out of her house into her yard and sees 25 years of her life laid out on the grass for strangers to bid on.
An auction of this nature is not merely a financial transaction. It is the psychological erasure of a lifetime of labor. She walks past her sewing machine, which clothed her children.
She sees her butter churn, her meticulously sterilized canning jars. Every object is tied to a memory of survival.
She sees the massive 4-gallon crock she used for rising bread dough. And looking at that crock, she remembers one night when the yeast was particularly aggressive.
The dough rose so high it spilled out over the rim, cascading onto the kitchen floor.
Bert, her husband, quietly walks over, scoops the massive mound of dough up, and plops it back into the crock. And then Bert just starts laughing hysterically.
Because stuck upside down in the middle of the dough, covered in sticky flour, are his best pair of black leather boots.
It's such a beautifully human, funny moment. But standing there on auction day, the weight of losing it all crushes her.
She looks over at Bert, sees a look of pure, unadulterated sorrow on his face, and she breaks.
She walks away from the crowd, hides behind the well house, smells the wild mint growing nearby, and just sobs as she listens to the auctioneer's hammer dismantle her life.
It is a profound portrait of grief. However, we must follow the trajectory of that grief. The auction, practically speaking, is a success.
They manage to secure $425 for their old Model T alone. They take that capital move to British Columbia, and Matilda ends up living to be 93 years old, outliving all of her siblings.
The family absorbed the heartbreak of the Depression, adapted, and relentlessly kept moving forward. This tenacity propels them into the final major shift in our narrative, which is the explosion of the modern era.
The 1940s to the 1980s, the author of the centennial book Marcel summarizes this transition with a brilliant phrase. He says the family finally traded the era of wood and grass for the era of iron and wood.
The sheer technological whiplash they experienced is staggering.
We are watching a family evolve from medieval agricultural practices to mechanized industry in a single generation.
We go from Moyes yelling at slow-moving oxen to haul a single log to his sons Arthur and Wilfred pooling their resources to purchase a massive Twin City gas-powered tractor and a mechanical threshing machine.
They aren't just farming their own land anymore, they're industrialized. They start doing custom mechanical harvesting for the entire district.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the boundaries of their world explode. Look at Paul. Paul enlists and fights in the horrors of World War I.
During the absolute slaughter of the Battle of Vimy Ridge in 1917, Paul is reported missing in action. His family assumes he is dead in the mud.
He is eventually found alive in the field hospital with a severe crippling shoulder wound from shrapnel. He survives and returns to Canada, but his arm is damaged.
He can no longer physically drive a team of heavy draft horses. His agricultural career is over.
So he pivots. He leverages his intelligence and takes a position with the Department of Indian Affairs. By the 1930s, Paul is acting as an Indian agent responsible for a jurisdiction that covers a massive sprawling territory in northern Alberta and the Northwest Territories.
In his early career, he executes his duties using the old methods. He travels by pack horse and slow river boats for 2 solid months just to deliver treaty payments to remote tribes.
And he's doing it carrying stacks of $1 bills because that was the only denomination trusted in the Deep North at the time.
But the territory is simply too vast. So Paul adapts to the bleeding edge of technology. He abandons the pack horses and starts utilizing small, single-engine bush airplanes.
Paul is suddenly flying through the Arctic skies with legendary daredevil Canadian bush pilots like Wap May and Punch Nickens.
They are flying through blinding blizzards, executing desperate mercy flights in the dead of winter to drop critical medical supplies to starving, isolated communities.
They are landing on tiny, unplowed clearings in the snow, surviving by the absolute skin of their teeth. In a matter of decades, Paul went from riding in a wooden wagon pulled by oxen to flying over the frozen Arctic tundra in an airplane.
The family's engagement with global conflicts continues to push them outward. Wilfred, despite being older, enlists in the mechanical engineers during World War II.
He spends 3 years stationed in England using his mechanical expertise to inspect and repair advanced military equipment. The footprint is now global.
And even back on the home front in Saskatchewan, the speed of change is dizzying. Judith takes over the management of the main ranch. Up until 1940, tractors were massive bone-rattling machines with spiked steel wheels.
They tore up the ground and moved at a crawl. One day, a machinery salesman drives onto the property and demonstrates a new tractor equipped with rubber tires.
Rubber tires! It seems so mundane to us, but George recognizes the paradigm shift instantly. A rubber-tired tractor moves faster, saves fuel, and saves the driver's spine.
George buys the rubber-tired tractor on the spot. And the old steel-wheeled Twin City monsters retired to the scrap heap that very afternoon.
The continuity of the land through all this change is remarkable. That original piece of dirt the homestead Moyes carved out of the wilderness in 1887 after trading his gold watch remains firmly in the family's grip.
The stewardship passes from George to Henri and eventually down to the fourth generation, Gilbert and George, who are operating it by the 1980s.
And the scale of what Gilbert and George are doing in the 1980s would have looked like pure science fiction to Moyes and Sophie. By 1981, they are running a 26-quarter ranch.
That is a massive expanse of land. Back in Sophie's day, harvesting that much wheat required a 22-man threshing crew, a massive cookhouse, and weeks of back-breaking manual labor.
But Gilbert and George, they are doing all the work with just 2 men. No hired hands, no massive crews. Just 2 guys sitting inside the sealed air-conditioned cabs of massive satellite-guided combines and tractors, iron and wood.
I want to dwell on the sheer compression of history we've just traversed.
Yeah.
Human evolution usually moves at a glacial pace.
But in a single overlapping lifespan, Moyes and Sophie went from trading a gold watch for an Indian pony to survive a violent rebellion to sitting on their porches watching their children drive Chevrolets down paved highways.
They watch their grandchildren fight in global mechanized wars across the ocean, fly airplanes over the Arctic, and eventually wire their homes for computers.
Listener, I really want you to visualize this. Think about your older relatives, the family members who helped compile this incredible centennial book in 1987. They personally witnessed this entire sweeping arc of human history.
Their memories bridge centuries. They remember being little kids, terrified that the croc-mitaine was hiding under their beds.
They remember watching Matilda's frozen piglet thaw out and twitch on a cast iron oven door. And those exact same eyes lived to see the moon landing test tube babies and the dawn of the internet age.
And all of that history, all of that violent, beautiful, relentless progress is contained entirely within the borders of your own family story.
It is the ultimate testament to human adaptability. Your ancestors did not just passively observe the tide of history. They wrestled with it, they engineered solutions to it, they absorbed its heartbreaks, and they built an enduring dynasty out of it.
Which brings us to the end of our epic sweep today.
Let's just take a breath and look at the mountain we just climbed. We started in the freezing wilderness of 1670s Quebec, standing next to Suzanne as she meticulously cataloged a small family mirror to build a legal fortress around her children.
We walked with Moise as he swung a pickaxe in the Rockies and traded his gold watch in the dirt to save his family.
We watched Sophie build a complex thermodynamic refrigeration system in her well and secretly brew 10-gallon batches of beer.
We saw their kids hook stray dogs to sleds and haul water. We felt the suffocating grief of the Depression Pierre, selling his massive black horses to pay a surgeon, and Matilda crying behind the well house at her farm auction.
And we watched the family aggressively conquer the modern world, trading wood and grass for air-conditioned tractors and Arctic bush planes.
This raises an important question, a question directed specifically at you, the listener. We've spent this time looking backwards, analyzing the grit and the sacrifices of your ancestors.
When Moise first looked out over the unbroken prairie of Jackfish Lake in 1887, he was stepping blindly into a vast, terrifying unknown.
He had no guarantee he would survive the winter, let alone that his descendants would thrive centuries later. But today, his unknown is the exact foundation that made you who you are.
Exactly. So here is the provocative thought I want to leave you with to mull over on your own time. Think about your life right now.
What present-day struggles are you wrestling with?
What seemingly mundane everyday decisions are you making right now? Decisions that feel as ordinary to you as Suzanne demanding an inventory of her spoons, or Moise bordering the pocket watch that will become the legendary foundational bedrock for your own descendants 100 years from now.
You are currently standing in the middle of your own unknown. What legacy are you unwittingly building today?
A profound perspective to carry forward. Listener, thank you so much for trusting us with this incredible family archive.
It has been an absolute privilege to guide you through the epic sweep of this history.
And remember, keep an eye out for our future deep dives, where we will zoom in and explore the specific incredible stories of the individual family branches. Until then, keep stepping onward into your own unknown.